Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
That is Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi. You can check them out Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. until noon. My name is Lawrence Holmes, and we have a huge show ahead of you today. And Herbie's out, but Jordan's going to stick around and run my board. Jordan, my man, let's go.
Color analyst for the White Sox, Steve Stone.
Try it with your bare hand. It's a lot easier that way.
Joins Lawrence Holmes.
Steve Stone is a Cy Young Award winner. He is a fantastic color analyst for your Chicago White Sox, and he is a score baseball expert.
As Steve was saying, try it with your bare hand. It's a lot easier that way. Steve actually poked his bare hand in the booth and has cut himself open.
Steve Stone talks with Lawrence Holmes.
I'm about to pass out.
Yeah.
Lots of blood.
Social media god Steve Stone and Lawrence Holmes right now on The Score.
Yes, this is very exciting, especially considering what happened last night. Steve Stone joins me on The Score Hotline, which is presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Stoney, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm terrific, Lawrence. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and in the last 2 days have been a lot of fun because we get to see that big smile and the big bat of Eloy Jimenez back in the lineup. You were looking for it in the second game more so than the first because of the jitters and the excitement of him being back. What does he do for the White Sox lineup?
Well, first of all, if you pencil out what he's going to do in a full season, you figure he's probably at the point of his career where it's 40 and 120, give or take. I mean, that's the home runs and runs batted in, which is essential in the middle because this is a day and age where home runs are paramount. But the Sox have a really unique situation going that I don't think anybody could have seen coming when the season started. Right now, they're 25th in the major leagues in home runs. That's way down there. Nobody could see that coming because they didn't know they were going to lose 70 home runs in Eloy and Luis. And again, give or take a few here or there. But with being 25th, they're fifth in the major leagues in runs scored. Nobody believed this team would score runs by taking a lot of walks, getting some doubles, getting key base hits, whatever. That wasn't the way this team was built, and it wasn't the way the team was supposed to be built. They play in a ballpark at guaranteed rate where home runs are paramount. It's a really good home run hitter's ballpark. And so what they're doing is pretty amazing, and I don't think enough people give this team the credit for being resilient, for being adaptive, for being able to create a lot of offense out of essentially whole cloth, and for doing something that the team wasn't built to do. A lot of credit goes to the coaching staff, Frank Medichino. It goes to a lot of the folks who are involved on a day-to-day basis with understanding how to win games when you don't have a lot of thunder. And it certainly has a lot of credit given to Tony La Russa for holding this team together, for making a really good atmosphere in that clubhouse, regardless of what anybody thinks they have heard. These guys want to play. They are going out there, and the key to a manager, whether you like the manager or not, whether you respect him or not, whether you recognize his past accomplishments or not, the key is, will you play for him? I mean, I played on a wonderful team in Baltimore where most of the guys didn't particularly care for Earl. Now, I came to really like Earl after I retired and we were both doing television together. But when I played for him, he wasn't a likable guy. And he explained to me why. He said, I got to get the most out of my players. And to do that, I thought I had to be a jerk. He said, maybe I didn't, but that was just me. That's how I got the most out of my players. Well, that was Earl's style. It's not a whole lot of other guys' style, but that's what he did. And every manager does the same thing. They act toward their players and treat them in a way that gets the most out of their team and gets them on a daily basis to bust their butts for him. And that's exactly what's going on. Whether it's 26 against one philosophy, whether it's we're all in this together philosophy, it doesn't really matter. The end result in baseball is winning. However that manager gets his team to win, that's what you're supposed to do. And every manager has a different style, and there have been some great ones. And Tony is one of the great ones.
It's a one-game sample of Aloy out in left field. And I know that he had done a nice job down in Charlotte in the games that he played in left field. I felt like I was looking at a sleeker version of Aloy, which as you're rehabbing, you're staying in shape, you're probably doing a lot more cardio and stuff than you would if you were just with the ball club. But is that something that the White Sox can look at and say, okay, well, maybe we have a better version of Aloy because he's in better shape?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, Lawrence. Number one, I look at Aloy and his personality, but his inner strength, a lot like I look at Jose Abreu. Now, they're completely different personalities. Jose is a lot more reserved than Aloy, as we've seen when Aloy makes his post-game high moms and everything else. And they both have an inordinate amount of pride, and they both have a desire to make themselves wonderful players. Otherwise, they wouldn't be where they are. But there's degrees. You know, these are the best of the best. There's degrees of the best of the best. And Aloy has a lot of pride. He doesn't like to hear that he can't play left field. So I think one of the reasons why he maybe was a slimmer version of him, why he's running a little better than he did before he got hurt, I think one of the reasons is one of the motivation factors that people will use to get the most out of a given player. You know, let me tell you something. You're not that good. Ricky Renteria challenged Jose Abreu at first base. He said to him, you want to be a DH? Because that's where you're headed. We can't play you in the field. You're not good enough. So if you don't want to be a lifetime DH, you better get yourself good at first. And Jose, with the pride he has, made himself a very good first baseman. I think Aloy is in the process of trying to show everybody that he can be at least a decent left fielder. Last night, he was a wonderful left fielder. I mean, he threw Taylor out at the plate by 15 feet. That was a terrible coaching job, but still, you got to make that throw, and he threw it on the fly. He made two really good catches out there. I mean, he did a lot of things really well defensively that you just don't see from Aloy. And I like the fact that he did it all by staying on his feet. Made a great catch off the grass. He stayed on his feet. So, yeah, we're seeing a better Aloy. We're seeing a faster and probably a slimmer Aloy. But I think it's not only just that he rehabbed from his upper body injury. It's that he wants to show everybody that he's pretty good out there and can be good, that he's a better athlete than everybody thinks. And, you know, the only thing I say is if the coaching staff can impress upon him that they need him on his feet, because we need, over the course of a year, we need those 500-plus at-bats out of you. We don't need you on the IL any longer. And so last night he looked pretty good doing it.
Would you have walked Abreu to get to Aloy? And I mean, I understand it, but I also don't, because Abreu was struggling a little bit. What did you think of Matheny's strategy in that situation with two out?
I didn't think Mike had a particularly good game.
Me neither.
But I don't think this was the worst of his mistakes. And the reason is I understand his thinking there. Jose Abreu is one of the premier run producers in all of baseball. And I know he's not swinging it well, but he has a tendency to step up at big moments and has since he's put on a White Sox uniform, but especially the last 2.5 years. So what Matheny is thinking there, and I'm not going to tell you it's wrong or right, I'll tell you what he's thinking. He's thinking, Abreu's really hurt us in the past. He's hurt everybody in baseball in the past. I got a guy who's playing in his second game after missing 99 of them. And he's swinging okay. I mean, you know, the one hit he got was a little looper to right field that looked like a 90-degree wedge. But, you know, I got to take my chances. I know this one guy up first can really hurt us. I'm going to take my chances that this other guy coming behind him is not ready yet. In essence, that really psyched up Eloy. Again, the pride comes in. Nobody wants to see anybody walk in front of him. But that wasn't the most egregious thing for me that Mike Matheny did.
Was it the hit and run against Lopez?
No, that was terrible also. But that wasn't the most egregious thing he did. That was a horrible decision. And again, you know, it's one of those things. But for me, the worst thing that he did was you got one left-hander in your bullpen and you've got six or seven right-handers out there left, including Staumont, who is a really good one, 5 for 5 in save situations. And he goes and he brings in the left-hander, Brents. Well, what you do when you bring Brents into the game are two things. Number one, you turn Leury around to the right side. Leary's a better right-hand hitter. He's a natural right-hand hitter, not left-hand hitter. So by turning him around to the right side, he starts out and doubles down the line. That was number one. Number two, after Leury, you know you're not facing Collins. You know you're going to get Engel off the bench. Well, he wound up hitting him, putting two on, nobody out. But now you have a succession of right-hand hitters. They're all right-handed after that, including the meat of your order coming up. You know, you start out with Anderson, and everybody's right-handed after that. You got Brents in there. And I'm not sure, you know, how quickly he got up the reliever after him, but when you got a load of right-handers, you want to face, number one, you want to face Leary from the left side. Then you're going to get Collins, who's not hitting very well because you're not going to bring an angle, I don't think, against a right-hander. And then you go to the right-handers coming up next, and who knows how long you're going to keep him. That, to me, was the thing that lost the ball game for them. That was the most egregious mistake on a night where Mike made a lot of them.
Is there something to take from what we've seen from Reynaldo Lopez in his relief appearances, and specifically last night? Yes, Matheny let him off the hook, but he also buckled down and got his command right, and we saw some excellent velocity from him.
Yes, you did, and you always do see excellent velocity, and I think there is something to be learned. It's that, boy, what a wonderful trade piece that would be.
Okay. I mean, I think that that's fair. I think that there's a lot of talent in there, and maybe the right type of manager and pitching coach can get it out of them. And yeah, you're right. Well, it could be something. What do you think the White Sox need? If Rick Hahn were to ask you, what would you say they need?
Well, I'm not going to tell you specific names, but I will tell you that, number one, I think that everybody realizes that they need some bullpen pieces or a piece in the bullpen. I mean, you know, a lot of people have wanted Michael Kopech to start. He's not going to start this year, folks. That's just not the way this pencils out. Also, you don't have near enough time to stretch him out. And you also saw last night what a weapon he is in that bullpen. I mean, a phenomenal weapon, whether it's the seventh, the sixth, or the eighth, whether you're using him as a multi-inning guy or a supreme major league setup man. I mean, last night, some pretty good hitters had zero chance against him. He was 99 with life upstairs. The slider was unhittable. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't come around too often. When you can use him for just one at bat where he can kind of lay back and say, here it is, that's pretty tough. So that part is good. Getting another arm out there would be really nice also. And there's a few. You can look around to various teams. I mean, look at every team that is an also-ran team. You know, you take a look certainly at the Diamondbacks. I don't think the dealing is done in Pittsburgh yet. You can look at Pittsburgh. They're an also-ran team, and they have some pieces that are interesting. You know, you look at some of the other clubs. I'm not sure about Texas exactly, but there's some teams that will be active as sellers. And this is what the Sox are trying to do. People don't understand. Their philosophy is, why would you not strike early while you have a whole list of people who are available? Well, there's still a lot of people available. I mean, Kimbrel is probably the number one bullpen piece out there. He does have an option left for a year. He's going to cost a whole lot of money because a lot of people want him. But you got him. Scherzer's a starter. He's a guy that is out there. And, I mean, he's really interesting. He actually, because he wants to go to the West Coast, he could tip the balance of that entire National League race in the West,
yep.
which would be pretty interesting. You know, you've got Escobar with the Diamondbacks. He's still out there. A lot of people mentioned Ian Kennedy from the Rangers. He's out there. Daniel Hudson from the Nationals. The Sox know him very well. He's out there. And if you're convinced that his arm is okay, that's a pretty good piece also. I don't think they have any interest in Pineda, but Richard Rodriguez from the Pirates is pretty interesting to me. You know, you've got Jonathan Scope out there. If you believe that Scope can play second base, that might be interesting in lieu of, you know, whoever you're going to get, because it's not going to cost you that much. I don't think they have any interest in Starling Marte. You know, there's a lot of other guys that still have, number one, a lot of value, and number two, are available.
Stoney, as always, I appreciate the time. I'm looking forward to you getting your Bertucci burgers next week. Thanks for being on the show.
Lawrence, I will tell you one thing. These are two of my favorite days of the baseball season. The 2 days before the trade deadline, because you want to watch everything that you can see. Michael Givens just went from the Rockies to the Reds. This is really an interesting time. I just love it, and I think everybody else should really enjoy it.
I agree with you. Have a great call tonight, Stoney.
Okay, Lawrence, take care.
That is Steve Stone, the Score's senior baseball analyst. Love talking with him about what's going on with this team. And Aloy, we need to take a break. Why? Because I have a special guest that is joining us. If you are someone that loves soccer, don't turn. No. Men in Blazers host Roger Bennett, who is a crazy White Sox fan, is going to join me. That's right. Right here on The Score. Next.
Lawrence Holmes live from Chicago, middays noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and Odyssey Station.
Thank you so much for hanging out here with us today. Steve Stone, as always, was great talking about the return of Aloy Jimenez to the White Sox lineup. I'm actually going to ask my next guest about that, too. And you might not think, wait a minute, you're going to have Roger Bennett on the show and you're going to ask him about the White Sox? You're damn right I am, because he's a Sox fan. He knows and loves this team and has for a really, really long time. You should get his book, Reborn in the USA, An Englishman's Love Letter to His Chosen Home. Wherever you get your books, and Roger, from what I've seen, would like you to go to your local bookstore to get them. He joins me now on the Score Hotline, which is presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Roger, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Oh, Lawrence Holmes, it is a joy to be with you and a genuine delight to be with Chicago.
So let's start with the White Sox. You know, White Sox fans are very excited about where things stand right now with this team. I imagine you were excited too, as it looks like they have a real chance to win it all this year.
We deserve this. What can I tell you? It's been a long, bloody time, Lawrence Holmes. We have waited in the wilderness, and it is a remarkable moment to see the patient get rewarded. I mean, it's been... feels like it's been forever, and I don't like to jinx it, but I'm coming to throw out the first pitch on Saturday, and I believe I'm going to give Tony La Russa a good 6 or 7 innings.
Okay, well, good. The White Sox could use a little bit of bullpen help, so of whatever you can do to help out. Have you already started practicing throwing out the first pitch?
You know, I have, by watching Mariah Carey throw out the first pitch on YouTube, which is an incredible tutorial of how not to. You know, it's bloody terrifying. It is bloody terrifying that the reality is that I'm not a baseball player. I'm a baseball fan because when I was 15, and this is all in my book, you know, I dreamt of Chicago. I told myself, growing up in Liverpool, a magnificent city, but one that has fallen on hard times in the 1980s, I told myself I was an American trapped in an English boy's body, which is how I really survived the kind of industrial collapse in England in the 1980s. And I dreamt of Chicago, the town of John Hughes, the town of the Chicago Bears Super Bowl winning team, and the town my great-grandpa always dreamt that he was going to move to when he left Eastern Europe in the early 1900s. We should have been there. We should have lived in the great hog capital of the world. We never made it, but I obsessed about the city and came over as a 15-year-old to spend the summer there in the northern suburbs of Highland Park. Big shout out to New Trier. And Old Comiskey was the first ballpark I went to on that trip. My trip was very much like Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That film was really a documentary of the month I spent in your fantastic city. And I went to Old Comiskey first, fell in love with the game. It was like watching chess played with chewing tobacco. And I've been a White Sox obsessive since, a huge Chicago Bears lifetime fan. I'm coming to the city this weekend, and genuinely, it's the joy of my year to be back by the lake.
Reborn in the USA is the name of the book, an Englishman's love letter to his chosen home. That connection with your grandfather, he was a butcher, right?
That is true. And the Chicago, known as the hog capital of the world. And my great-grandfather was the one who fled Eastern Europe, like thousands in the early 1900s. And the family myth was that he was headed for Chicago. That was where you made your fortune as a meat man. And the boat docked on the way to New York in Liverpool to refuel. And my great-grandfather was one of the low IQ individuals who saw the one tall building on the Liverpool skyline, pointed at it and said, "We're here. We're in New York. Everybody get off the boat." And thus my family became stranded in Liverpool, the northwest of England, for 70, 80 years. And, you know, it was a dark time. The steel mills had shut down, the coal mines, the cotton mills, and Liverpool, this once great port city, had really fallen on hard times when I was a kid. It was, you know, high unemployment, no hope, a huge heroin epidemic. And I survived by feasting on American television, movies, books. You know, the Chicago Bears Super Bowl winning team, that run just thrilled me, showed me as a kid, 14-year-old, that you could throw off an identity of losing and become a winner. You could swagger. You could talk, you know, you could talk crap and then back it up by smiting all comers. And just dreaming of Chicago, that's what helped me survive. And I always told my grandfather, you know, when things were hard, I'm going to move there. I'm going to complete the family's journey. I'm going to become a Chicagoan. And you know, everybody makes up stuff. Everybody dreams. And I'm just blessed to have made my dream come true, which is partly because of William Refrigerator Perry and Walter Payton. And meeting those guys and talking to them really changed my life. But I did, at the first opportunity, moved to Chicago, and everything's happened because of that.
I'm fascinated by the fact that you kind of, this almost Forrest Gumpish way that you end up running into the Chicago Bears after their game. What was it that Refrigerator Perry said to you that gave you that warm feeling that Chicago was the place to be?
I did tell myself I was an American trapped in an Englishman's body. This was before I'd even set foot in Chicago. And I was lucky enough to find a pen pal. Young listeners, that is a person who, before the internet, you would write words on paper. They're called letters. And you would mail each other and you'd tell each other what happened in your life. And I timed it. I got a Chicago pen pal from Northbrook, the great Jeff Owen. And we wrote every week during that Chicago Bears Super Bowl winning year about, you know, the games, how it was progressing. I became so obsessed because the games weren't on live in England. I there was no internet. So to follow along, I would dial random 312 numbers in Chicago and call them up during game time, and people would answer. And if you were a listener who I spoke to, a strange English boy called you during a Bears game in 1985, and said, "Hello, can you tell me how the Bears are doing?" And Chicagoans, strangest Chicagoans, would talk to me for 35, 40 minutes, give me their own private commentary. They'd be like, "Jim McMahon's dropped back. He's looking left. He's looking right. He fires. He finds Willie Gault, 23rd. And I would follow along with long-distance phone calls that cost a fortune. But it was worth it because these guys were just incredible. They loomed larger than life to me. I had William Refrigerator's Perry's poster above my bed, leaning against the refrigerator. And when I came over at the end of that summer, he invited me to spend a summer on the beach in Highland Park, Glencoe. And the only downer of the whole thing, it was amazing. It's such an incredible city, such an incredible city to be young in, to experience life in, to live a life very much like the one depicted in the John Hughes movies. The Bears had gone over to London to play the first ever Wembley game, the American Bowl against the Dallas Cowboys. So I expected in my childish imagination to be hanging out with Mike Ditka, to be watching them train, to be with the Bears. And they were in London, which is, you know, near where I was. I was where they should have been. We'd simply swap places. So So I watched the game. The Bears did win. It was at Wembley. It rained. I was happy it rained because I'm a horrible human being. I was happy the English people got wet watching my beloved Bears that I couldn't be with. And then the commentator, at the end of the story, he said, and the Bears are going to turn right round tonight, fly right home to continue preseason. And I just said to my host, I said, we've got to go to O'Hare to meet them. And, you know, my mother would have told me to go right to bed. But America being America, they were like, sure, get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Go to O'Hare. You're 15. You can handle it. And so I went, and the Bears arrived at about 4 a.m. at international arrivals. Mike Ditka, the coach, came out first with his cigar, tried to stab it in my face and said, leave these men alone. They're your heroes. And I just flashed my camera in his face, and they all came out one after another. Walter Payton, the most wonderful human being, the greatest Bear to ever pull on a jersey, you know, talked to me forever. It was really beautiful. My camera jammed. So this is one of the great regrets of my life. I never got a photograph of me and Walter Payton, who was so patient and posed forever. Never got the photograph. But then William Refrigerator Perry bounded out with a whole entourage. I ran up to him. He put his huge arm around me and he leant into my ear. And Lawrence, he said to me the following. He said, dream big dreams. I did. You can do it too. And, you know, now we both work in sports, Lawrence. I'm sure you recognize that as an amalgam of every cliche any athlete says to any kid they want to get the heck away from. But back then, I was 15. He'd whispered in my ear, move to America. Do it, Roger. Don't just talk about it. Do it. And I swore that night I would move to Chicago because William Perry told me to. And that's exactly what happened. So thank you, Fridge, if you're listening.
Roger Bennett is the co-host of Men in Blazers. He also has a book that you should go buy because there are stories like this in the book. Reborn in the USA, an Englishman's love letter to his chosen home. When I've heard you talk about your immigration story and how it was so important to you to not just come to Chicago, but become an American citizen, when did you realize that those dreams were possible? And when you got to both Chicago and got to be a citizen, did it turn out as well as you had imagined when you were in Liverpool?
That's a great question. Now, I moved to Chicago because William Perry told me, among other things, as soon as I could, right after university. I arrived in the city. I didn't know anyone. I had no friends. I had no family. I had no work visa. You know, I arrived. I looked at a map of the city. I saw there was a place called Rogers Park. And I was like, sounds amazing. My name. I'm going to move there. And I did. Big shout out to East Rogers Park. Four of the happiest years of my life. Hanging out there, savoring the, you know, the bars, the jazz clubs, the blues clubs, just everything that is so singular. It felt very like Liverpool, in that Liverpool's a city of dreamers and talkers and hustlers and people who love the land. It's the thing I love about Chicago and miss most about it is just the way the stories of the city just are so held onto by the people that live there. It's a deeply historic city, and the history seems to seep out of almost every block of that incredible city. And you know, life, the reality of anything is always different than the American idea. The American reality, the American idea, those are two very different things. But I will say, I wrote in the front of the book the Langston Hughes lines, the great American poet, as my epigraph. Let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be. And I wrote this book in COVID. I wanted to retrace my steps. The idea of America, Lawrence, is the idea that's animated my entire life. It's the biggest, it's around the idea around which I've organized my life. I have four American kids now, an American wife. There's not a morning that I don't wake up here. And thank God that I live in this country. And when you have gone into to become an American, when you have gone to a naturalization ceremony and held your hand up and said the oath with 162 other people from 42 countries. And afterwards, you talk to them, human beings who, you know, I just escaped Liverpool. They escaped civil war. They escaped famine. They escaped conflict and worse. And you talk to them about their journey and you hear, you know, how America has given all of us. That's the one thing we shared, the 162 people in that courtroom in Manhattan. That America had given us all courage, had given us all confidence, had given us all joy, hope, meaning, and belief that anything is possible. And when you've done that, and I'd encourage all of your listeners to go to a naturalization ceremony, anybody can, you never take being here in America for granted.
Considering when you wrote the book, you said COVID, but there's also a really contentious presidential election that was going on. There was civil unrest. There were people that were speaking out, fighting for their rights throughout this country. Were all of those things like things that allowed you to reflect on your experience? And like you said, like the American dream versus the American reality, that you were able to draw on all of these things and add it to what it was that you were searching for to come here?
Oh, Lawrence, that's such a great question. And I love coming on your show. Thank you for asking me. It's exactly why I wrote the book. I built my life around sport. I adore sports. They allow me to, you know, feel things like hope, joy, victory, defeat, agony, ecstasy that normal people feel in real life, but I'm dead to inside. So sports is my everything. And when they stopped during COVID in Manhattan, where I live, Manhattan, which I had painted on my bedroom wall when I was a kid, you know, I made it here. I moved here. I lived here. And then the city was overrun by COVID. It was, you know, we've almost repressed the memory. But those early months, late March, April, May, there was chaos. There was fear. There was darkness. As you say, we plummeted into the Black Lives Matter summer, which was a human agony and a trauma to witness. And then into the election, toxic election cycle. And I want to, when the present is full of challenge, I think it's a natural human emotion to retreat into the past. And that's what I did. I wanted to, you know, this American love that I have, I wanted to almost like breadcrumbs through the enchanted forest. America has saved me. And I wanted to plumb the contours of that love, to remine it, to look at the shows that I'd grown up with that had sung like sirens and lured me to this land. You know, Fantasy Island, Heart to Heart, Miami Vice, Moonlighting, Cheers, these classics. And, you know, William Perry, the Super Bowl Shuffle, going to Old Comiskey, Run DMC, Public Enemy, Tracy Chapman, and re-examine them, which is what I did. And what I realized is, you know, I love America. I absolutely love America. My love was a childish love. And any adult who understands love differently than a child will know what I mean when I say ultimately adult love is work. You are in love with something, but you know it's not like a child that it's just a giddy thing. Love is an ongoing challenge. Love is something you have to work at. Love is where you accept the object of your love for its strengths and its weaknesses. And as you said in your first question, my book is about the American idea. There is an American reality, and I dedicate myself, and I think many of your listeners do, to closing that gap between the American idea and the American reality with every ounce of our strength.
I appreciate you giving me so much time, but I do want to ask you a couple more questions. We're talking about Roger Bennett.
Can I just say, to be on the air in Chicago is just like the single bloody greatest thing for me. So I adore you, and whenever you want, let's keep it. Let's do it.
All right. Well, I want to talk to you about the Beastie Boys because I love the Beastie Boys like you love the Beastie Boys. In fact, I want to send you something that I think that you'll appreciate. Please. So we'll talk about that afterwards. But I love the Beastie Boys, and I'm a big fan of Paul's Boutique. I'm a little younger than you, but so I feel like that to me like really showed their evolution and how they were getting ready to change and into the next.
Agreed.
You know, it's such a beautiful album and so beautifully produced, but I can't even imagine what a young Roger Bennett must have been feeling when the Beastie Boys come to London and they're doing all of the stuff from Licensed to Ill. You talk about seeming like pugnacious rock stars. That was the Beastie Boys at their zenith of their malice. And I love the mental picture of you being like, oh my God, this is what they do in America?
Yeah, I mean, you've nailed it. It's hard to describe. I was in Chicago the summer Run DMC really really blew up. They were on MTV in heavy rotation with Walk This Way, which turned out to be the worst track on that album. I mean, everything was just so much better than that. But that was the track that broke them through with Aerosmith. And I was blown away. Yeah, they made me realize the music I'd listened to, the Smith, REM, was really the music of passive, wistful longing. And Run DMC, you know, were fire hoses. They spat out words of boast and wonder, and then they made those boasts and wonder, not unlike the Chicago Bears. They made them real. They made their dreams real. And then along came the Beastie Boys. They came out, you know, my last 2 years of high school, where, you know, we were all ready to go mad with the world, just go, you know, on the lash, off the deep end. And License to Ill was the perfect soundtrack. We didn't understand it in Liverpool. You know, when they'd say things, we'd understand like the word Brooklyn. We'd understand the names that they were kept shouting out, but we didn't know what we had no idea what a brass monkey was. We had no idea what Crystal Burger was. We had no idea who Anthony Mason was. But we were just loving it. You know, what we loved most was that these were three friends, you know, who bullcrapped their way into touring with Madonna and dating Molly Ringwald, and had a, you know, they were the joke. They were in on the joke. It was just very bloody clever and insane. They just seemed to us like the kind of kid in the back of class that every class has, where they just shout out as much as they could and get away with as much as they could because they could. And so they did. They came to Liverpool, which is on the last date of their 8-leg License to Ill tour. And it was an insane moment in British history. Just the moment they landed, the British tabloid press, you know, the Piers Morgans of the day, the utter idiots, they just went foamed at the mouth in moral indignation about these three guys who had the apex of their show was a giant penis popping out of a box on the center of stage, because the manager of the Beastie Boys had said to them, "Dudes, you can have anything on stage, whatever you want." And they said, "Really? Whatever we want?" And that was them. That was why. And so if a giant penis was going to pop out of a box in Liverpool, I was going to go and see it. And everybody went down, and it was electric. You know, before the gig, the whole of Liverpool looked like it had just raided a vintage store in New York. Everyone was there looking like an amateur B-boy with a VW ripped off a car on a chain around their neck. And this was an incredible moment, because, you know, this is the band that we'd all modeled our life around, was in the same bloody room as us, a couple of thousand people, sold out gig. And then the Beastie Boys made a terrible mistake. They mention it in their documentary, but they mention it in passing with a bit of humor. It wasn't funny. It was dark. Before they came on stage, the offstage MCA shouted, and this is the apex of my book, the climax of my book. MCA shouted, "F you, Liverpool!" And, you know, you can do that in Birmingham. You can do that in London. You can do that, I'm sure, in Cincinnati. You can do that in Los Angeles. But that is like in Liverpool, that is like insulting someone's mum to their face. Those are fighting words. And they bounded on stage, started with Slow and Low. And just Liverpool people started to throw their beers, which I've never seen Liverpool people waste ale before. But they threw cans of beer at the band and canned them off stage before they could get like a minute into the first song. And then Ad Rock came back on with a baseball bat, started to try and swat the cans back into the crowd, and a full-scale riot turned out that the police had to tear gas. And it was a night that went from just apex excitement to just utter horror and violence. And that was really the night. The Fridge told me to come to Chicago, but that was the night. There's an old adage in England that if you give an Englishman the choice between his success and your failure, he'll choose your failure every time. And instead, I realized if I stayed in Liverpool, you know, we instead of enjoying the Beastie Boys, instead of having a memory we'd have for the rest of our life, we prefer to bring them down to our level. And that was really the night that I went home and decided, as a more of an adult teen, Chicago was where my future was going to be.
Buy Roger's book, Reborn in the USA, An Englishman's Love Letter to His Chosen Home. Roger, I loved this. I'm really appreciative of you being on the show. And the next time that you come back on the show, I actually ask you about soccer. But because I am a masochistic Arsenal supporter. So I've got questions.
The first words are redundant. The first two words are redundant. I mean, can we just say, you're an office holder. I mean, it's like being a Chicago Bears fan, Lawrence. It's like being a bloody Bears fan. It's incredible. Can we exhume Sid Luckman? Can we just exhume Sid Luckman? Get him back as our QB1. I mean, I'm trying to hype myself about Justin Fields and this season ahead. But that's ultimately the joy of sports, being an Arsenal fan, being a Bears fan. I'm an Everton fan. You have the ability to make the best case for yourself before the season. We get ourselves so hyped. Ultimately, almost all the time, we are like Sisyphus, just rolling a rock up the mountain, knowing it's going to slip out of our fingers. But the joy of Chicago sports to me, it's why I love the city. It's why I'm so bloody excited to come back and be at the White Sox game on Saturday with my oldest son. My God, that is America, where you can come as a 15-year-old and be blown away by the game and the ballpark and the team, and then get to come back and throw with your oldest kid a pitch. That's the cycle of life, man. But the reality, that's the joy of sports. When those things go well for us, Lawrence, when Justin Fields leads us to the promised land, my God, Chicagoans, Arsenal fans, Everton fans, whatever, we know not to take it for granted, to celebrate as if we're at our own kid's wedding. And I wish that to you and everyone in Chicago very soon. Come on, the White Sox.
I'm with you on that. Roger, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're a beautiful man. Thank you. Thank you, Chicago. Courage.
That is Roger Bennett. Go buy that man's book, Reborn in the USA, an Englishman's love letter to his chosen home. I'm super late, and guess what? Don't care, because that was outstanding. Back after this on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, live from Chicago, middays noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and Odyssey Station.
Like that.
Oh, Eloy Jimenez! Do not walk anyone in front of him! Wow! Welcome back. Hi, Mom. See you later. 5-3.
Thanks, Cubs. I thought that would be part of the highlight, too. That highlight was courtesy of NBC Sports Chicago, Jason Benetti, Steve Stone on the call. Eloy is risen! He is risen! I still think that I understand the logic of, well, this guy hasn't played in a little while. I just think it's such a bizarre move to walk with two outs in a break. Never mind. This isn't the Mike Matheny show. We all know that he's not very good at managing baseball. But Eloy cranked that, Soldier Boy. He cranked that. It wasn't, maybe it gets over the fence. It was like as soon as you heard the sound, you're like, yay! I've heard that sound before, and it is glorious. It is a glorious, glorious sound. Thanks to everyone who has given their feedback on the Roger Bennett interview. I know that. Look, I'll just tell you, I had it in my bag of things that I wanted to talk to him about. Soccer was on the list because he's the host of Men in Blazers. But I'm telling you that the stories that are in his book were so fascinating that I really wanted to dig into the love of Chicago, this weird run-in that he had with William Perry, and the immigrant story. So I'm hoping that you're okay with the creative choice that I made in the interview. And my hope was, if things went well, that Roger would come back on the show at some point, and then we could do all the footy that we want. I said it on Twitter, and I'll say it here to you. If you're going to the White Sox game on Saturday, cheer that man loudly. Because not only did he choose Chicago, he also chose the White Sox, which we don't get chose a lot. So the fact that he chose the White Sox to me is really significant. I've done a lot of interviews in my career here at The Score. That is on the list of my favorites. And I hope that you enjoyed it too. But we're not done. The show's not over yet. You know why? Because we've got a Bears roundtable coming up. Someone texted that I should have just left Roger here for the Bears roundtable. You're right, but he had other stuff that he needed to do today. That's okay, though, because I've got Dan Durkin and Anthony Herron. They're going to join me to talk about the Bears for the next half hour. Everything you want to know about this team is coming up next here on The Score.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.TV. Watch every out-of-market regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.